This podcast of Word of Mouth is sponsored by
Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money
through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto,
home, and personal loans.
Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
And Dartmouth Hitchcock.
Creating a new model for healthcare.
Where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system
improving the health of our communities
for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And Doucet Survey.
Serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England.
Now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine.
Information at DOUCETSurvey.com. That's DoucetSurvey.com.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby, in for Virginia Prescott. We've heard it all before, kids these days. Those entitled, narcissistic, superficial, coddled, basement-dwelling millennials. Sound familiar? Well, today we're posing this question. Do millennials really deserve the label of aimless, risk-averse, and narcissistic? Or are these social media-centric digital natives taking steps towards a future that focuses less on the self and more on big problems facing the world? To answer those questions, Virginia spoke with David Burstein, author of Fast Future, How the Millennial Generation is Shaping Our World.
David Burstein, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks. Great to be with you.
So you are a millennial, 24 years old, class of 2012. I guess the first question is, do you not drive and live in your parents' basement?
I do not have a car. And I do not live in my parents' basement.
Was a joke. I mean, but it speaks to this issue of the one size not fitting all, as you write.
Yeah.
The millennials are the largest generation in history, 80 million in the U.S. So why do you think your generation gets so pigeonholed?
Well, you know, I think that we have this tendency in our culture to think about generations really as a way of trying to understand the changes that are happening in our world. And so we do this thing where we lump groups of millions of people together. In this case, it's a group of 80 million people. And of course, there's no way you can say any one thing is true about that entire group of people. But it's such a pronounced change. It's such a change that is happening at a particular moment in our history where our whole world is going through a lot of changes. So the things that are happening in this generation, I think, are perhaps more deeply felt, and people are having more direct interactions and experiences. As one of the largest groups in the workforce, there are a lot of employers. A lot of these perspectives come from employers who are dealing with young people every day. And I think there's a great tendency right now to confuse youth with this generation. This generation really cares deeply about trying to make a difference in the world, trying to be engaged in meaningful work. It's a generation of people who are the most diverse, the most educated in history, and it's also a generation that is in the process of, you know, building towards a day when we're going to make up a third of the electorate in 2020, and we will make up the largest consumer force in the economy in the next couple of years. So people are really trying to understand this generation, but the changes in the ways we're looking at work, love, relationships, how we communicate are different than generations before. So I think a lot of people are still trying to figure this out, but there's some tendencies that people fall back on in terms of ways people have looked at youth in the past.
All right. Well, let's dig into that a little bit. Millennials characterized now as anyone pretty much under 30. A couple of the adjectives used to describe the millennials, they're militant nostalgists. You know, they grow the sort of Civil War era beards and drink old fashions and grasshoppers and mint juleps. Their pop culture is all about flat affect, you know, into mumblecore movies and, you know, all attitude, no plot TV shows. Also overscheduled. Now, you are 24. You already have a really dense resume. Were you overscheduled in high school and in college?
Well, I was by design heavily scheduled. I would not describe myself as overscheduled because, you know, that seems to imply some kind of unhappiness or increased stress. For me, I chose to do a lot of things because they were things that I wanted to do and because I felt like there were things that were possible for me to do. I think one of the themes we see among this generation is the ability to do something like start a business or, you know, be able to put information out, be able to publish, be able to do things that previously you needed to ask permission of institutions in our society. You need to say you want to be a musician. You used to have to go and say, hey, will you let me use your studio so I can record a demo? And then you had to go say, hey, will you play my demo now? You can take that, play it in front of your camera. You can put it on YouTube and you can get that and you can actually book gigs. So I think there's a whole change in the kind of barriers that people have had. In this particular moment, it's possible to do more than one thing. And then you have to be a multifaceted person in order to succeed in today's economy and today's world. You can't just know, you know, one ability to move one piece from point A to point B. It's simply not enough for the complex world that we're living in. Everyone's looking for people who have more than one talent. So I think it leads to a lot of this kind of development, which is more, quote unquote, scheduled, and there's more going on to one person than one thing. I think it's a good thing. I think it's actually valuable because it's making people constantly curious.
Right. I hear you, David, and I hear, you know, when there are no gatekeepers, you are kind of in competition with everybody, so you have to get out there on your own initiative. But, you know, unpaid internships, not paying for music and downloads, people's intellectual property not being paid for, is that going to carry the future?
I mean, you know, certainly unpaid internships are much more popular than they have been in the past, and people have been able to get away with that. People are thinking about money and the relationship to what people should pay for, I think, very differently than they used to. I mean, you see it just in the fact that the internet, which is fundamentally free, and much of the stuff on the internet is free, even though it's one of the largest drivers of commerce, you know, that is part of the frame that this generation has grown up in, and understanding that information should be free. And I think that that concept, it plays out in a lot of different ways. People feel they have a right to have high quality information for free. So when you look at, you know, the New York Times, for instance, you know, going, you know, shifting away from a free model to a pay model,
Yeah.
You know, they were smart to add exceptions for the links that came through Twitter and social media, because they knew that young people, even though the content is of a high quality, were not yet in the frame of mind to say, this is stuff worth paying for. So I think that that notion is really changing in terms of how much information is worth. It's not actually a devaluing of the information, which I think what people sort of miss. It's being raised in a world where we said that this quality information is part of our right as people, as members of society, to have good quality information for free. And that transcends into how we think about all sorts of things, and also the economic reality. If you know you can get something for free and it's become socially acceptable to get it for free, and you're not making a ton of money and you're in a, you know, a lower wage economy, it makes it more reasonable for people to go out and do that.
Well, one thing that we know costs a lot of money, education. Education columnist Rebecca Schumann, she's been a guest on this program. She recently wrote an article for Slate, and it was called The Sad Demise of College Fun. So she wrote there, much of the unstructured free play at college seems to have disappeared in favor of pre-professional anxiety. An entire generation of students seems hesitant or unwilling to veer from the straight and narrow in a collegiate setting. Any truth to that, David? College tuitions, of course, are rising, job markets slowly recovering from a tremendous blow. Are college students wary of taking risks or taking liberal art courses that may not even pay off?
I don't think that's true. I mean, in fact, if you look at the freshman survey, which is done out of, I think, UCLA, you know, been done for a number of years, there's been a sharp decline in the used to be that business was the number one major, and now that's becoming less and less popular, and things like political science and English and things like that are rising again. I think that, you know, the question of practicality is, you know, or practicality of whatever you major in or whatever that might be, I think that is still very much in the side of people wanting to take risks. In fact, it's a generation where, you know, we have seen stories and instances of people taking risk and being rewarded, whether they're entrepreneurs or whether they're young people who have sort of staked their claim into the world right out of college. It's much easier to do that. I also think there's a sense of of realizing that when you are now in your 20s, the life that's ahead of you and the amount you can do, the amount you can accomplish, I think it's actually greater, and people recognize that, than it has been in the past. The ability to, you know, how much an individual can do in 1 year today versus how much an individual could do in a year 30 years ago, that has changed, that has increased. So I mm-hmm. think it gives people a lot more willingness to take risks because you say, okay, well, I can try this, and if it doesn't work out, I'm going to be on this planet for another 90 years. So what's the worst they could possibly happen? So I think that that ability to see into the future and think about the future as being very, very long is really helping millennials actually take those risks, which, again, I think is a good thing.
We're talking to David Burstein. He's the author of a book called Fast Future, How the Millennial Generation is Shaping Our World. And how about this? How about the complaints about the helicopter-parented generation? You know, they always had to wear helmets and knee pads as kids. And if they got bad grades, their parents swooped in and intervened with teachers. What does that mean for their human agency, especially politically, something that you are really interested in? Millennials are seen as politically being apathetic.
Well, first of all, millennials are not politically apathetic. In the last two election cycles, millennials voted among the highest numbers that they have in recent history, and in fact voted at parallel patterns to where their parents voted when they were the same age. But you will also see, for instance, 50% of millennials, although millennials tend to vote Democratic, 50% self-identify as independents. So there's a frustration with the current political environment. There's a frustration that politics is not the best way to make change at this particular moment in history, which I think is a sentiment echoed by people of all generations. So the second point, you talk about helicopter parents, you know, I think that the effects of that are a mixed bag. For some millennials, I think it has a positive effect. It's allowed them to spend more time sort of incubating, thinking about what it is they want to do. You know, millennials have much closer relationships with their parents than anyone in previous generations. And a lot of that means that when we actually are ready to go out into the world after college, it means, you know, if, for instance, if you stay at home and live with your parents, and this is a trend that has been a little bit overblown in terms of how it's happening, and it's happening for some people, for a lot of millennials, that means saving money. That means having more time to figure something out. It means the ability to take a job that's more meaningful, do work that is more preparatory for what you want to do later. So I think it's actually preparing people to be more thoughtful about where they're headed, and I think it's having a closer relationship with your parents is not necessarily a bad thing as long as there's that independence. I think now parents and millennials in particular are moving into a role where parents are our mentors, friends, advisors, helping us navigate our life and our world. And individuals have always had people like that in their lives.
David Burstein, representing for the millennials. Thank you for providing a ray of hope.
My pleasure. Thanks. So great to be with you.
David Burstein there, author of Fast Future, How the Millennial Generation is Shaping Our World. He's also the CEO and co-founder of Run for America, an initiative aimed at bringing a new generation of political candidates into national office. Today we've been breaking down some of the stereotypes about millennials, the under 30 generation, so often derided as entitled, coddled, and risk-averse. Well, Aaron Wheels' Fotheringham story flies in the face of that stereotype, rather literally. Fotheringham is a wheelchair motocross athlete. He's used a wheelchair since he was a kid and wouldn't have it any other way. How else would he be able to perform tricks like double backflips and challenge the notion of what disability means? Lauren Ober brings us his story.
Aaron Wheels Fotheringham is perched at the top of a 50-foot giganta ramp in the middle of Madison Square Garden. His wheels are pointed down the precipitous slope toward a gap the length of three parallel parked cars, which he intends to jump. The crowd is going nuts. They've never seen anything like this before.
Aaron, I just want to know, what are you doing up here, buddy?
Well, when I asked you guys for a wheelchair accessible ramp, this is not what I had in mind.
This mega ramp is about as far away from wheelchair accessible as you can get. But the joke is part of his shtick. This is a guy whose license plate on his souped-up truck reads legless.
Well, since you're up here, you gotta do something. You know the rule, you can't go down the stairs. What do you have in mind?
Well, I was thinking, if you guys get really loud and you follow me on Instagram, I was gonna do a front flip!
A front flip! Do you wanna see a front flip from this guy tonight? Hey!
Now, anyone doing a front flip off of anything is pretty impressive. But it's all the more spectacular when the person doing the trick is buckled into a neon green wheelchair. The 22-year-old Wheels has spina bifida and has used a wheelchair since he was in grade school.
I'm not paralyzed at all. I have spina bifida, and it affects my back and blah, blah, blah. All that boring stuff I've never really read.
He's also an adrenaline junkie and an action sports nut. If it involves big tires, big air, or big consequences, Wheels is into it.
I love adrenaline, you know, even before skate parks, like, I'd definitely knock on people's doors and roll away as quick as I could with my friends.
Wheels does what he calls WCMX, or wheelchair motocross. It's like BMX, except with four wheels instead of two. Oh, and a disability thrown in, just to keep it interesting. Wheels practically invented the sport. There are other wheelchair users out there doing WCMX, but Wheels is the undisputed king. He's gone bigger and jumped farther than anyone. You ever see an average guy in a wheelchair do a double backflip? No? That's because only Wheels can do that. Wheels got his start in action sports in Las Vegas after a trip to a local skate park with his older brother. He was 8 at the time.
I'm sure I'm not the first one to ever drop into a skate park on a wheelchair, but I didn't see anyone before me. I just looked up to BMXers and, you know, X Games, and I was like, well, I could do that. And then my brother helped me, you know, get to skate park on my wheelchair and pretty much pushed me into a bowl. And, I mean, from then on, I was hooked on it, and it, you know, it was a fun challenge, and, you know, I just fell in love with the sport.
Sorry, when your brother pushed you into a bowl, I mean, did you fall? Like, the angle of that is not meant for somebody sitting, right?
No, like, I mean, in fact, the first couple times I went down, I face planted and, you know, hurt my wrists. But, you know, he kept helping me back up, and then, like, after a couple tries, I mean, I rolled away from it.
And before Wheels even hit puberty, he was a fixture at his local skate park on his wheelchair. Wheels uses the term on a wheelchair rather than in a wheelchair. It might sound like semantics, but for a guy who doesn't feel confined by his chair, but rather liberated by it, the words make a difference. Soon the skate park became too easy. Wheels needed a bigger challenge.
After a while of putting in hours, you start progressing and doing bigger tricks and bigger drop-ins, and then I did a 360. Then that got boring. Then I wanted to do a backflip. And kids at the skate park were saying, you should learn a backflip on a wheelchair. I think they were just messing with me, but I took it serious.
So Wheels went to an action sports camp and practiced flipping into a foam pit.
And in 2 days of going to that camp, I landed the first wheelchair backflip in history. And then I was just like, whoa, this is fun.
That all leads us to now, with Wheels touring the world with Nitro Circus Live, a sort of extreme variety show for action sports led by motocross legend Travis Pastrana. Wheels is an integral part of the spectacle, which also features some of the world's best skateboarders, BMX riders, and daredevils of all kinds. Think people jumping monster ramps in igloo coolers and Barbie cars. Of all of the athletes hucking themselves off of tall things, and hucking is the term the kids use, none gets as much applause as Wheels.
Now, folks, Wheels has just casually said, do you want to see a front flip? And I've been telling you how tough this guy is and what an inspiration this guy is.
Then the announcer tells the crowd how Wheels knocked himself unconscious trying this trick before.
He used to do it off a 30-foot gap. But now that he's here in New York City, he wants to do it for you guys for the very first time over a much bigger 50-foot gap.
Oh, mercy.
So, New York! Do you want to see a kid on a wheelchair from a front flip?
Oh, my goodness!
And with that, Wheels descends down the five-story ramp, Fireworks spray out of his specially designed wheelchair as he picks up speed. He hits the lip of the ramp and tucks his head. And by some miracle of physics, his wheelchair, named Rolanda, follows. He flies over the gap and lands with a bounce, wheels down on the other side. A giant airbag catches him before he hits the arena wall. The crowd loses it. It's equal parts breathtaking and unnerving watching wheels soar so high above the ground. Wheelchairs are most definitely not supposed to do this. But don't try to tell wheels that.
Wheelchairs got a misconception or something, because I feel like people are always trying to put a limit or a stereotype along with it. And that's what I'm trying to break, that yeah, I'm on a wheelchair, but I can go down a 50-foot ramp.
Please hear some love for Aaron Wheels following her.
That story was produced by Lauren Ober for WBUR's Only a Game. You can find videos of Aaron Wheels Fotheringham in action on our website, wordofmouthradio.org.
Word of
mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of
mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby, in for Virginia Prescott. A successful professional hopes to win back his wife after infidelity. A bank clerk, crowding in on 30 and hoping for a family, moves in with her compulsive, demeaning boyfriend. A bartender, who fancies himself a poet, cheats on his pregnant wife. These characters all live in the faded beach towns and leafy suburbs of the New England coast and are the subjects of four loosely connected novellas in Andre Dubuque III's book Dirty Love. Virginia spoke with the National Book Award-winning author when Dirty Love was first released. It's now out in paperback.
The National Book Award-winning author of House and Sand and Fog and Townie again presents gritty, frustrated lives on the skids of the American dream. Andre Dubuque, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you for having me, Virginia. I really like that phrase, the skids of the American dream.
Well, thank you. Well,
yeah, it's good writing.
Well, and it's one of the things that we do see quite a bit in your books. I'm thinking of a point in the book, in the story, The Bartender. He's kind of reviewing hard luck stories that he hears from waitresses. And I was curious about what makes you so interested and maybe such a canny observer of these down and out stories.
Well, you know, I grew up down and out, like a lot of us. You know, I was from a family that was a member of the educated working poor, and, you know, I grew up around a lot of people who were facing, you know, financial hardship and addictions and violence and jail terms, and it just kind of hardwired me to see the world that way. And I, you know, frankly, it's made me a happier person, because I don't expect life to be easy. I expect it to be hard, and when there are moments of grace, it's quite lovely. But, you know, there is no story without trouble. You know, the word we throw around a lot in, you know, creative writing classes, in English classes growing up, is conflict. I prefer the word trouble, because that's all you need to get a story going, you know. You don't necessarily need all-out conflict, but you do need trouble. And the truth is, I think if you scratch the surface of any human being taking a breath right now as we speak, they're in some kind of trouble. That's just normal. That's just how it is.
And these troubles and the manifestations, the addiction, the violence, the jail terms, these cut across class lines and neighborhoods in these stories. In our first story, listen carefully as our options have changed, we meet Mark. Now, he's a project manager, very successful. He envisions his strong matrix falling apart. I'm interested in this idea of him trying to manage a relationship like a job, or assuming that he can.
Well, you know, first of all, writers are horrible vultures, right? We hover over people's lives and take notes without even realizing we're doing it. You know, a good friend of mine's a project manager out on the West Coast, and I noticed that he was bringing his job home with him whenever I would visit. He was, you know, that job requires you to be controlling, and that's, you know, the strength of being that kind of person. But when you come home, you don't want to be controlling the people in the house too much, do you? Mm-hmm. And but I found that he was doing that with his wife, and so I was exploring that possibility, that thought of, well, what's it like when what you're rewarded for at work is a liability at home. And those set of skills. And yeah, Mark Welch in that first story comes to find out that his wife, who was cheating on him, may have had her reasons.
We see a similar urge for control, at least in The Bartender. He assumes, like Mark, that he can at least put the chaos in a manageable form. He as he acts out with this waitress Jackie, he thinks one last time, and then I'll quietly sort of pull out before the damage is done. So there's this faint hope that as stupid as he's been, it will all be fixed one day. And it seems like you have a kind of sympathy for these characters that, you know, they're almost smothered by their own, I don't know, ineffectualism, but they hope that it will change. I'm curious about how you develop them.
One of my favorite lines from a Springsteen song is, "Everybody's got a hungry heart." You know, and we all do. And so the way I try to get into these characters is I have to withhold judgment. You know, I cannot judge these people at all. They won't show up. It's really kind of Ouija board weird, but it's the same thing that happens in life. If you judge someone in life, if you prejudge them, no one, they're going to feel it and know it. And what are they going to do? They're going to walk away from you if they have any sense of self. And that's true for characters, too. They'll walk away if they feel you judging. So they show up more when I find that if I step into the writing of characters with really authentic curiosity, where I'm not judging, I'm really just asking, what's it like to be you? They tend to start talking. They start to write themselves, and the story starts to happen on its own. And it's this wonderful trance-like state the writer gets into. And, you know, a lot of writers are afraid to talk about this out loud, but I will. It's really why I write, to get into that state when it takes off on its own.
So you can feel that. You can feel that distinct change.
Yeah, and, you know, I, in writing classes and conferences and whatnot, I find myself putting it this way, that I think there's a difference between imagining something and making it up. Anybody can cobble together a story and make it up. It can be actually fun. But that's different from imagining it, where sometimes it just doesn't ring true. Often it doesn't ring true. And the thing that you don't even want to write about is the thing that rings true. And you have to go with that. And, you know, this just is my whole thought about this creative writing thing, is that I think when you're writing honestly and deeply and nakedly with true emotion, true authentic curiosity, you're descending into your dream world. And what you want to write about is irrelevant. You know, Blaise Pascal, the 16th century philosopher, inventor, said anything written to please the author is worthless. Which I kind of hate that line because it's so harsh, but I believe it's true. So, yeah, that's the fun of it. And the terror of it.
We're speaking with the National Book Award-winning author Andre Debuse. He's with us to talk about his new book, Dirty Love. Well, and I'd love to talk a little bit about how these characters that you set up and what shows up. Many of them had these absent fathers or emotionally absent fathers. The men are mostly friendless, Mark nor Robert. They don't know who to call in a crisis. And they also wish that they had a cause. Both of them have this kind of sense of envy when they see the war memorial in town. You know, Mark thinks, well, maybe I am a coward. So it's interesting. We have the image of the soldier. We have the image of the success story. Are we missing another model of manliness to follow?
Well, now you're in my little wheelhouse. You know, I try not to ever think about theme when I'm writing. I try not to say anything when I'm writing. But, you know, it's really interesting in hindsight to hear you talk about these stories in that way. For me, you know, I don't purposely make these characters not have male friends they can turn to in a crisis. I don't purposely make them hunger to be part of something larger. But I think that these characters coming out of my dream world represent my belief that so many men, especially of an older generation, which frankly right now is mine, grew up in a time where, you know, it wasn't cool, and it's still, to a large extent, it's not accepted to be intimate with other men emotionally because of this fear of being gay and all this other crap that men, boys have to put up with. And I think I'm simplifying too much, but it's very complicated. I think that while women and girls have a horrible anvil on them in other ways, the anvil that boys have on them is that they've got to be winners. They've got to come ahead. They've got to be the alpha male in the room. And this isolates them, and I think sends so many men down paths of doing things in their lives that they wouldn't otherwise do.
just to get rewards that are hollow in the end, empty, and leaving them, you know, like Mark Welch, you know, financially successful in his career, but absolutely isolated spiritually, emotionally, and frankly, in his heart.
We do have another character, however, the lovely, gentle Uncle Francis. Now, he did fight in Korea and spent years drinking to try and forget about the experience. Still has his own baggage, certainly, but he gives us a sense of time passing, even in the way he observes things. One thing I was struck by is, you know, he's driving through his tawdry little town and notices the boarded-up Woolworths, which is in so many New England towns. In this generation, listening to rap, and he thinks they all look like convicts now. You know, they're all tattooed and pierced. And he is a man who it seems like is trying to let go of those judgments, both external and internal. Tell us a little bit about discovering Francis for you.
Yeah, I can hear your affection for him in your voice, and I feel the same way. I had finished the three other stories first, and I had submitted the book. I thought the book was done with those three, and my editor said, "No, I think there's got to be one more." And as soon as she said it, I began to sense and feel an old man, and I've never written from the point of view of an old man, and I also sensed the presence of a young girl, they're really just kind of shadowy. But I hung up as quickly as I could from my editor. And I began to just kind of stare at the page. You know, Flannery O'Connor says there's a certain grain of stupidity the writer can hardly do without, and that is the quality of having to stare. And very quickly I saw Francis, 81 years old, tending the flowers of his dead wife. And I was kind of off and running. And then somewhere in there was his 18-year-old niece living with him, a great niece. Mm-hmm. And I knew I had something to work with there.
The characters throughout these stories walk in and out of each other's lives. You know, Mark and his wife were regulars at the Whaler. That's where Robert tends bar. Devin busses tables there. She thinks Robert is a creep, by the way. Marla works at the bank with the man who had an affair with Mark's wife. So how important was it? Were these connections while piecing together the stories?
Well, let me tell you quite honestly, I wasn't aware of the connections till my editor pointed them out.
Huh. Must have been that dream life again.
It's a dream life. Seriously. She said, are you aware that they're working in the same bank and these two work in the same restaurant and you've got them both in the same beach area? And then I realized that it was happening on its own. You know, what I love about writing is everything. But I think what I love most about it is how it feels when you're writing well, that you're excavating something, that you're slowly digging and brushing off artifacts, and then they come to life. You think you might have an urn on your hands, and before you know it, it's the top of a building. Before you know it, you realize you have a city. And, you know, that's what happened when I saw the connection between those stories, and I simply allowed it, and it was it's kind of enjoyable that it was happening organically without... I wasn't trying to write a book of linked stories. They just kind of appeared.
Mm. For me, you know, as a reader, thinking that these people that pass by our lives, the bank clerk, the woman who's bussing our table at the restaurant, the man, you know, leaning over in a garden, they all have their, as you put it, trouble.
Well, see, no, and that's really why I was so happy to have these connections pointed out to me. But my editor is that... It bolsters my belief that every life is sacred. I'm sure you and your listeners have had this experience where you make eye contact with someone at the airport, someone who smiles at you really warmly, and you see the glint of intelligence and life in their eyes, and you have about a half-second connection between you two, just making contact. And as you walk away, you know you will never see him or her ever again the rest of your lives. And to me, that's just remarkably poignant and beautiful, and it makes me, I always wonder what's going to happen to that man or woman, you know, and you know, what's going to happen to me? And, you know, I what I love about the whole idea of trying to write character-driven fiction and reading character-driven fiction is that it pulls you into the heart of another. And, if you know, frankly, I think the deeper we go, there is no other. So I do like that the stories are linked very loosely in that way. For that reason.
Well, Andre Dubuse, what a pleasure speaking with you. Thanks so much for your time today.
I thank you, and thank you for reading that book.
Andre DeBuse III is the author of House of Sand and Fog and Townie. His latest book, Dirty Love, is now available in paperback. In 2013, writer, journalist, and college professor George Saunders made a short graduation speech at Syracuse University. It did what many commencement addresses do these days. It went viral.
So here's something I know to be true, although it's a little corny, and I don't quite know what to do with it. What I regret most in my life are failures of kindness. Those moments when another human being was right there in front of me, suffering, and I responded sensibly, reservedly, mildly. Or to look at it from the other end of the telescope, who in your life do you remember most fondly, with the most undeniable feelings of warmth? Those who were kindest to you, I bet. It's a little facile maybe, and certainly hard to implement, but I'd say as a goal in life, you could do worse than try to be kinder.
Later, that same speech became the subject of a short film, and eventually George Saunders adapted it into a book called Congratulations, By the Way. He spoke with Virginia last spring.
Can you talk about one of those regrets that you mentioned in your speech, the girl from the seventh grade?
Sure. Well, you know what I found is when you're doing this kind of speech, you want to pick the least egregious regret that you have. You know, so this one was a girl in middle school, basically, who came to our town, and she wasn't exactly bullied, but she was sort of teased a little bit, and kind of, you know, she was kind of this embodiment of what we'd read about in our religious classes, a person who is in need, and but at the same time, one, not having exactly the courage to do it, you know, that feeling that if you go to save a drowning person, you might get pulled under, which in middle school is especially acute. So, I mean, I suppose like most people, I just kind of turned the other way, basically, and then she left town, you know. So this speech that I gave at Syracuse, originally I gave it in 2004 at our daughter's middle school graduation. So in that case, it was sort of like a link to the middle school years, you know. But that, among many other kind of failures of kindness, still kind of resonate with me. And as I'm getting older, they seem to kind of loom larger.
Then you adapted that speech for college graduates, young adults in their early 20s being surrounded by messages, you know, to dominate in one field, to excel, to succeed. You know, the perception is that there's very little room for considering kindness.
So to me, it seems like I totally sympathize with this generation. And when we have daughters who are in their 20s, and you can just feel the way that they've been kind of, in a way, set up. Because on one hand, as kids, they were told that anything was possible. And then the financial thing happened, and we're like, oh, actually, almost nothing is possible. And that's a really cruel double whammy. But I would say in the long view, you know, in the long view, and it's hard to say this because you feel like you're preaching, and I don't mean to sound that way, but to get one's spiritual house in order is going to be sound thinking no matter what weather you find yourself in. I mean, God knows you could get yourself in a position of such wonderful, godlike prosperity that you could turn into a horrible person if your focus wasn't in the right place. And certainly, you know, I've been in that situation of not working and trying to, scrambling around the basement of American capitalism, trying to make things work out. That can be a soul killer, too. So I think what I was trying to say in my allotted 8 minutes was, regardless of the weather at the moment, a healthy spiritual interest is an incredible coat for any kind of situation you get into. You know? And it was 8 minutes, so it was sort of a tough, that's a tough gig, you know.
Well, I'm not sure that I could hear, as a graduate from college, your message in the same way that I can appreciate its wisdom today. And who is it for? Is it the graduates or the big audience on YouTube?
You know, it was the last thing I had to do last spring before I got to go back to writing. So, and I'd been asked by my dean to do it, so I just, okay, I'll do it. And then didn't really know that it would get out into the world. I mean, I guess you always sort of hope it will, but I didn't, you know. And the day I gave it, it wasn't really any big deal. It was just sort of, yeah, good, okay, now go have your summer. So, but I think probably, yeah, I mean, I don't even remember who gave the speech when I was in college, you know.
Yeah, and I was thinking about that. Some admiral gave the speech when I was in college. I don't remember much of what he said. And I actually read something when I was looking up something about graduation speeches. Gary Trudeau, you know, the Doonesbury comic guy,
yeah.
Gary Trudeau. So he gave an address in the middle of the 80s and said, the chief function of the graduation speaker has always been to prevent graduating seniors from being released into the real world before they've been properly sedated.
I think that's totally true. And, you know, when you're given this was actually a convocation speech for the College of Arts and Science. So the big speech was the next day by some, I can't, again, I don't know who it was. But, you know, when you're doing a speech like that, you are taking into consideration the two-thirds of the audience that is parents and grandparents mm-hmm. and squalling infants, you know. So
yeah, there was a squalling infant in the film that I remember of your speech, actually.
Yeah, yeah. There was also, yeah, I mean, it's a pretty tough gig, you know, but for a story writer, it's great because it means you gotta, you don't have time to prove anything. You know, you don't really even have time to give examples. You're sort of just exhorting in a certain way. And I guess my thought was, you know, if there's some kid out there who has already had those thoughts, then that's a sort of an endorsement. Which, you know, in teaching writing, that's really the way it always works anyway, is the student has already come to a realization 85%.
Mm-hmm.
And just to hear the voice of quote-unquote authority say, you know, suddenly then it goes to 99% and they can execute it. So I don't have any illusions about it, you know, sort of having that big of an effect. But, you know, I guess, it was just nice. It was nice. Sometimes it's nice to say the things that you really believe mm-hmm. and to get out onto the sort of limit of sort of corniness. You
yeah.
know, I'm used to writing proper essays where you have to prove it. Mm-hmm. And here there wasn't really time, you know. And there are so many wonderful books that prove it. I mean, the David Foster Wallace speech, This Is Water, is a really mm-hmm. wonderful kind of 25-minute in his typically, you know, brilliant way, a brilliant piece of rhetoric demonstrating this idea or a similar idea about one's mind, where one's mind should be in the world and so on. So, yeah, it's been funny to see that this thing keeps having a life after that afternoon.
Right. People all over the world have watched it, talked about it, passed it on. It was made into the short film that we played a clip of, and now this book. But what was it like for you, George Saunders? I mean, do you feel like you have diminished in any way some of that regret that's been knocking around since seventh grade when you wanted to be
nicer?
No,
I mean, well, what has happened is I think I've given it a lot more thought. In other words, like this notion of what is kindness in the first place, and which I don't take up in the speech, but kind of like, well, okay, so if my goal is to become a kinder person, first of all, I have to define what that means. And that turns out to be a fairly big fish, you know, to say, well, kindness is not just being sweet. It's not just being acquiescent, not just being nice. Maybe it has to do with being helpful to people around you. That's a good one. But then when you start thinking about that, even that can get to be a pretty deep well. So I found it more frustrating as I get older that I am not in full control of myself, you know, that I can get irritable or that I can a day can go by in which I wasn't actually really there, you know, that kind of thing. And it's almost like, you know, when you're carrying a pile of papers and one of them falls off and you bend to get it and another one falls off and then four, you know, pretty soon the whole pile of papers is on the ground blowing across the yard. It feels that way to me that at this point, being so convinced that this is the main thing we should be thinking about, it kind of peeves me that I can't get better at it. And I think at 55, I've just realized that this problem, which is actually about kind of getting the ego in check, is really a huge, intractable, lifelong problem. And I started late, you know. So it's a little like you said, oh, I'll just roll this boulder off this mountain. I'll get started, you know, when I'm 55. And you realize it's actually the primary problem, and it's really stubborn.
I hope the graduates can hear it.
Yeah. But they're also nice anyway. You know, before I gave the speech, right before I was going to launch in on this tirade about kindness, a girl passed out in the crowd, and it was amazing to see every kid around her just leapt in and helped, you know, grabbed her, held up her head. Some of them were very smart to get out of the way so the paramedics could get in. And I thought, oh, my God, maybe I don't have to give this speech after all. I mean, this is a pretty natural human tendency. So I'm getting out of the kindness business after this one. Going back to my armed robbery group.
Thank you so much. Appreciate
Thank
it.
Thank you. Really enjoyed it.
George Saunders, MacArthur Fellow, winner of the Penn Malamud Award and the Story Prize. His new book is called Congratulations, by the way. Some thoughts on kindness. You can find more on the book and a link to watch his speech at wordofmouthradio.org.
Thanks for listening today. There's much more to hear and explore at wordofmouthradio.org, or you can save yourself the trouble and subscribe to the Word of Mouth podcast. And if you're into it, tell a friend. After all, the best suggestions tend to travel by word of mouth. I'm Taylor Quimby, in for Virginia Prescott. Join us for more Word of Mouth tomorrow at 2, right here on New Hampshire Public Radio.